from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. Now, back to the courtroom.
We need to... Is he getting the earphones? Okay. Calling is D101CR202340, State of New Mexico versus Hannah Gutierrez. Part of state your name?
Carrie Morrissey and Jason Lewis on behalf of the State of New Mexico. Mr. Lewis has stepped out.
Hannah, good morning. Jason Bowles and Monica Barreras. Carmela Cisneros are here with Ms. Gutierrez Reed.
All right, thank you. All right, is this your next witness?
This is.
All right.
The state calls Bryce Zimmer.
Do you swear affirm under penalty of law that the testimony you'll give in this case will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
All right. Have a seat. Talk into the microphone.
Is your microphone on?
Yes.
Okay. Mr. Ziegler, go ahead and just state your full name for the record.
My name is Bryce Ziegler, first name spelled B-R-Y-C-E, last name spelled Z-I-E-G-L-E-R.
Mr. Ziegler, how are you currently employed?
I'm currently employed by the Federal Bureau of Investigation within the Laboratory Division, specifically within the Firearms and Toolmarks Unit.
Can you give the jury a summary of your educational background and training?
I received a Bachelor's of Science in Forensic Science from the Pennsylvania State University.
And how long have you worked for the FBI?
Since the summer of 2011.
And since 2011, what positions have you held at the FBI?
I was initially hired into one of the DNA units at the laboratory. And I essentially worked as what's called a technician in that discipline. So I essentially did the majority of the DNA processing operations, but then a examiner would come in, review my work, review the profiles, and take it from there. In 2015, I transferred to the Firearms Toolmarks Unit, which is where I am now, and I was also promoted to a forensic examiner. So in this current position, I receive evidence that's related to my discipline, I perform the requested examinations on those items of evidence, and I issue the results in a formal laboratory report. And also, if I'm called to, I can testify to those results.
And, sir, other than your undergraduate degree, what kind of training do you have in the area of firearms and toolmarks?
In order to become a qualified forensic examiner in this discipline, I had to complete what's called the Forensic Examiner Training Program. And that program, it's developed and implemented by the FBI lab, and it's specific to each particular unit. So I had to complete the program specific for firearms and toolmarks. And this program, so I was assigned a mentor, and I was also given a training manual. So this mentor kind of guided me through the process, reviewed tasks in that training manual with me, and to essentially complete that process, I had to pass a series of written examinations, oral board exercises, practical competency tests, as well as moot court exercises.
Thank you, sir. And have you ever been qualified as an expert?
In court?
In court, yes.
Yes, I have.
And in what areas have you been qualified as an expert?
Some of those are general firearms examinations. Sometimes it's firearms identification, so that's the microscopic comparison of fired ammunition components back to firearms. I've also been qualified in shooting incident reconstruction.
And in terms of shooting incident reconstruction, did you do that kind of work in this case?
No, I did not.
And I apologize. We were having a technical difficulty here. In terms of the work that you did on this case, what what areas of expertise have you been qualified as an expert in that apply to this case?
Sure. I would say those two areas are the examination of firearms and also firearms identification.
Okay. Thank you, sir. We will ask the court to recognize, well, you know what, let me pause. Have you testified before?
Yes, I have.
And have you been qualified as an expert in other courts?
Yes, I have.
And how many other courts have qualified you as an expert?
13.
And are those all federal courts or state courts?
10 of those are federal, 3 were state.
Okay, thank you. I would ask the court to recognize Mr. Ziegler as an expert in firearms examination and firearms
identification.
Thank you. Identification.
All right. You are recognized as an expert in examination of firearms and firearm identification.
Now, it's okay. Thanks. You can have a seat. In this particular case, were you provided certain items of evidence for testing?
Yes, I was.
And approximately how many items of evidence were you provided for testing?
That's difficult to approximate because I was given a certain number of item numbers, but those item numbers may have, for example, 30 cartridges. So I believe that item numbers, I would say maybe around 50 items, but again, that could mean a much larger set of items.
Were you provided a firearm to examine in this case?
Yes, I was.
And did you have any understanding where that firearm came from?
I don't have personal knowledge of where the items of evidence are submitted from. They are generally submitted with some information that gets populated into our laboratory database. So I do have a description of that. That information gets populated into my lab report, but I don't have direct knowledge of where those items came from.
So what was your understanding, and I appreciate your qualification there, what was your understanding of where the firearm in this case came from that you administered some testing on?
So in this case, it was just labeled as a revolver. There was no description as to, for example, no address where that firearm was collected from.
You weren't given any information about whether it was collected from a movie set or whether it was a prop being used by an actor?
Your Honor, I'm going to object to leading.
I actually don't think that is leading.
Overruled.
I don't have that information.
Okay. I'm going to show you, what I have marked as State's Exhibit 97. May I approach? Do you recognize that?
Yes, I do.
What is that?
May I see that?
Mr. Ziegler, what did I just show you?
That is a photograph of the revolver that was submitted to my laboratory for examination.
Is this a revolver that you did testing on?
Yes, it is.
Your Honor, I'm going to move for the admission of State's Exhibit 97 and ask for permission to publish.
Any objection? No objection.
All right, State's 97 is admitted. You may publish. It was on my screen before.
And can I ask, is there any way for me to only publish to that monitor so that I don't have to walk back and forth? Just to his monitor so that it only goes to his and doesn't go to everybody else's when I'm going through the exhibits.
No, if it's published, well.
You mean to recognize it?
Correct.
We would have to keep turning it on and off.
Okay.
Or else you could, yeah, that's what we'd have to do.
Okay. Why don't we just take a minute and let me see if I can get an agreement so that we don't have to do that.
Okay.
All right.
Great. Thank you.
state will move for the admission and permission to publish throughout Mr. Ziegler's testimony of State's Exhibit 97, 97A, 98,
99, 100, 101, 102,
103,
104, 105,
106, 107, 108, 109, 110. So is
it 97A through 110? Did you skip anything? 97, 97A, and then 98 through 110. Any
objection?
All right. States 97 through 110 are admitted.
Every time we unplug it. All right, Mr. Ziegler, can we go ahead and put it up on the screen?
Yes, you can.
Mr. Ziegler, tell us a little bit about this firearm that was provided to you. What kind of a gun is it? And just generally speaking, how does a gun like this operate?
So this is an image, a photograph of the revolver that was submitted. And this is a single action revolver. So that means that the hammer must be manually cocked by the shooter every time that the shooter intends to fire. So some revolvers, if you pull the trigger, it will do the work of cocking the hammer for you and releasing the hammer. This type of firearm does not have that ability. The shooter must physically cock the hammer each time. Is this a touchscreen by chance?
Yes.
Okay. So to point out a few key areas of this firearm, the portion on the left, don't believe him.
He's going to come help you.
Thank you. So the portion on the left in this photograph is the barrel. Towards the center, we have the cylinder. This back portion here is the hammer. We have the trigger near the bottom. And this wooden piece is the grip. So this is where you would hold the firearm. Let me clear this out. So basically, in order to get this firearm to function, you would have to load cartridges into the cylinder. This can be accomplished two ways. You can't see it in this photograph, but on the opposite side is what's called a loading gate. You can open, and you then have access to the cylinder. So you can load each cartridge one at a time, rotating the cylinder until you have as many cartridges as you desire. You could also remove this pin here, remove the cylinder from the firearm, and load it that way. But regardless, once you load the cylinder, you must manually cock the hammer all the way to the rear, and then at this point, this firearm would be ready to fire. So a pull of the trigger would release the firearm, or excuse me, the hammer. The hammer has a firing pin that's fixed to the hammer. So as the hammer falls, the firing pin would strike the primer of the cartridge and fire that cartridge.
Can you give us a quick description about the notches on the hammer and the different hammer positions?
Yes, so as you would cock this hammer, it has several safety notches by design. So as you cock it, you're going to hear a series of clicks, and those are the safety notches. So as you start to cock it, you're going to hear your first click. That's the quarter cock notch. If you continue to cock it, you'll hear your second click. That's the half cock notch. And if you cock it all the way, you'll hear the third click, and that's when it's in its fully cocked position. So those intermediate two cocking positions, they serve to do two things. Number one, when the hammer is completely at rest or not cocked at all, the firing pin actually protrudes inside the frame. So it's very difficult to see here, but in between this gap between the cylinder and the frame, you would actually be able to see the firing pin sticking out. So as you start to cock it, it starts to remove the firing pin from protruding. So we don't want the firing pin making contact with the cartridges when we don't want it to. So it starts to retract the firing pin. And also, if I'm cocking the hammer and my thumb slips off the hammer, you would expect that it's going to catch in one of those two safety notches. So this is to prevent the hammer from falling unless you want it to. So really, this firearm is only designed to fire when the hammer is in its fully cocked position.
In terms of the, well, let me ask you this. The half cock notch, so that's going to be the second click that you hear when you're cocking the hammer. Is that correct?
Correct.
Is there anything particular about the half cock position other than it being a safety?
Can you elaborate?
Sure. What position does the hammer have to be in order to load this gun with ammunition?
I understand. So you have to have the hammer retracted to a certain point to allow the cylinder to rotate freely. So there's a part, and it's on the inside here, called the cylinder stop, and that cylinder stop does not unlock until the hammer is pulled back to a certain point. So once it's pulled back to a certain degree, you can freely rotate the cylinder to load it with as many cartridges as you desire.
So in order to load and unload this gun, if you don't remove the pin and remove the cylinder, it has to be in the half-cock position.
I'm not sure if it's somewhere between the quarter and the half-cock, but it is in that intermediate area, yes.
So once you get it into the half-cock position, what do you have to do to load it?
So I'll clear this out. Again, on the other side, there's a loading gate that you can open, and you then have access to the cylinder, so you can load it that way or remove the cylinder itself.
How many cylinder positions do you have access to when you open that loading gate?
Only one at a time, so you must manually rotate the cylinder and continue to load a single cartridge at a time.
So for those of us that are familiar with revolvers where you push a button and the entire cylinder kind of rolls out and you can load and unload that way, does this gun work that way?
No, those are going to be your more modern style revolvers.
If you noticed when you received this gun and you examined this gun, did this gun appear to be very old or relatively new, or were you not able to tell?
I'm not able to tell its age now.
Okay. Who is the manufacturer of this revolver?
The trade name is Pietta. It's an Italian company.
And do you know anything about Pietta and what they do, what they make?
I do know they have product lines they create new firearms that are essentially replicas of older firearms.
Is this a replica?
It's a replica in that it's an old design, but it's still a functioning firearm.
Now, if the hammer, let's talk about kind of hypothetically. Let's assume that this gun is fully loaded with live ammunition, and we have the hammer in its resting position, so it's fully down. Is that the position it's in this photo?
Yes, it appears so.
So how is this gun designed in terms of safety with regard to possible accidental discharges when the hammer is in the fully rested position?
Right, so when the hammer is fully forward, as I mentioned earlier, the firing pin actually protrudes inside the frame. So if you have the cylinder fully loaded and the hammer is at rest on a chamber that has a live cartridge in it, that firing pin is actually sitting on the primer of that cartridge. So if I were either to strike the hammer or if I were to drop it and it landed on the hammer, it's going to fire that cartridge. So if you hit the hammer with enough force, it will detonate that primer in that position. And that's part of the design of this firearm. That's just how these are made. And if you were to look at the owner's manual, which this is one thing I did as part of my exam, you would actually see warnings not to carry this firearm with the hammer at rest on a loaded chamber. So a lot of times it's actually advised that you load one less cartridge in the cylinder, so you have one empty chamber, and that's how it's carried with the hammer forward on that chamber. So these are recommendations in the owner's manual. So this isn't some phenomenon. This is something that's known about the design of these firearms.
And what kind of testing did you perform on this firearm?
So initially I did a function evaluation just to make sure it appeared that, you know, there weren't any odd modifications, that it was functioning correctly. After that, I was requested to do some microscopic comparisons, as I was also submitted a fired bullet and a fired cartridge case. And then the last type of testing I did on this particular gun is what's called accidental discharge testing. So essentially the goal of that test is to see if I can get this firearm to function without pulling the trigger.
So the first set of testing that you mentioned, what did that entail?
So a function examination is basically I need to inspect the firearm for safety purposes. Keep in mind I've never seen this firearm before when I first opened the box, so I don't know what condition it's been in, I don't know how old it is, I don't know how well it's been taken care of. So eventually I'm going to want to test fire that gun, so I need to make sure I feel that it's safe to fire so I don't have some catastrophic failure while I do so. Once I determine that it is safe to fire, I will physically take the gun to one of two locations in the FBI lab, and I will load it with ammunition from the laboratory and actually test fire the gun.
And did you test fire this gun?
Yes, I did.
Approximately how many rounds of ammunition did you fire out of this gun?
May I refer to my report?
Sure.
I physically fired this gun 12 times, so as a result of that, I retained the fired bullet and fired cartridge cases that I produced during that test firing. And I also collected some other cartridge cases as a product of the testing that I did. So these would be cartridge cases that I collected during the accidental discharge testing.
And the rounds that you fired, the 12 rounds that you fired out of this gun, were they evidence rounds or were those rounds that were supplied by the FBI?
They were FBI cartridges, and then once I fire them in the evidence firearm, they become what's called secondary evidence. And essentially, if I have to conduct microscopic comparisons at a later point, that secondary evidence, they now become my knowns. I know they came from that firearm because I physically shot it and collected those items.
All right, thank you. Tell us about the second group of testing that you did.
Right, that was the microscopic comparisons. So again, I was submitted a fired bullet and a fired cartridge case, and essentially I was asked to determine if, in my opinion, I could determine if those two items were fired by this particular revolver.
Okay, and let me back you up for a moment. Did you examine rounds of ammunition as a part of your forensic examination in this case?
Yes, I did.
And did you examine dummy rounds?
Yes, I did.
Did you examine live rounds?
Yes.
Did you examine live rounds? Well, did you examine live rounds that you understood to be provided by someone named Seth Kinney?
Yes, there were some cartridges that were submitted, and they were declared to be live rounds as they were submitted.
Did you examine live ammunition that came from a location that you were notified was 126 Monroe Street?
Your Honor, I don't object to leading.
I'm not leading. I'm just asking him a direct question.
May I review my...
Sure.
Thank you. Yes, I do have some item numbers that have that address in their item description.
Did you also examine live ammunition that came from the set of the movie Rust?
Yes, I did.
And when you examined that ammunition, what did that entail?
So the evaluation of the ammunition kind of took place in a couple different phases. So first, I just looked at the physical characteristics. So I evaluated its appearance from the outside. And based on that, I started to segregate these types of ammunition into groups just based on their physical appearance. So I could put them into groups. For example, some of them appeared to be live cartridges, so I had that group. Some of them appeared to be dummy rounds. And so they may have some physical visual clue that they may be a dummy. So for instance, some of them had holes drilled into the side of them. So I could look into the cartridge and see there was no powder present. Some of them, when you shake them, there are actual BBs inside. So that produces an audible indicator that even though this looks to be a live cartridge, in reality, there's nothing on the inside. So I can shake it, and that's another indicator that that may be a dummy. There were a series of blanks, which a blank does not have a bullet. It still has a primer and gas, but it's not meant to actually fire a projectile. So I started to form these groups just based on their physical characteristics. I then x-rayed all the ammunition because I could hear some of these cartridges had, it sounded like BBs inside when you shook them. So I wanted to get an idea of just a picture of what was going on inside these cartridges. So again, I took those two pieces of information, sorted them into groups, and then eventually I worked with the contributor to determine which of these cartridges actually need to be disassembled. So we can take out the bullet and we can look inside and see, is there any powder present? Does it look like the primer is active or not? So those were kind of the three phases to sort of determine which categories these cartridges actually fell into.
Okay, and quickly, I'm going to jump you to the accidental discharge testing that you did. Can you summarize for the ladies and gentlemen of the jury what that accidental discharge testing consisted of and why you did that testing?
All right, so again, accidental discharge, its goal is essentially to determine, can I fire this firearm without pulling the trigger? That's kind of the end goal. And the way we do that is, the test is designed to simulate the firearm being bumped or banged into something, just being jostled around, and seeing can those kind of interactions fire the firearm. So the way we replicate this in the laboratory is I will take the gun and actually strike it with a rawhide mallet on six planes. So if you picture a box sitting in front of you, the six planes would be the front of the box, the rear of the box, the left side, the right side, the top, and the bottom. So those are the six planes. So if you kind of picture the revolver and picture how those six planes work around that gun, I'm going to go around and strike the firearm in all six of those planes with a rawhide mallet. Again, trying to determine if it will actually fire without me touching the trigger.
And specifically, when you're striking the firearm, are you striking the hammer?
That was a part of the testing that I did, yes.
Prior to conducting that testing, did you have any thoughts about whether that could potentially result in damage to the gun?
Right, so this is actually in our standard operating procedures, that this type of testing is potentially disruptive to the firearm. So just kind of generally speaking, if I'm going to do an exam that may destroy or alter the evidence permanently, I would seek out the contributor's permission to do that exam before I actually go and do it. So that is what was done in this case.
So you obtained permission to proceed with that testing?
That's correct.
Understanding that it could result in damage?
Yes.
All right. Let's go ahead and, let's go ahead and just briefly describe the striking of the mallet and whether or not at some point there was damage and kind of what you learned during that test.
So as we're doing this test, we want to test the firearm in all modes of fire that it's capable of. So if I have a rifle, for instance, and say it's semi-automatic and fully automatic, I would do the test in both of those settings. In this case, completely different type of firearm, but I wanted to test this gun in all four positions of the hammer. So at rest, quarter cock, half cock, and fully cocked. And essentially, as a result of that testing, there were only two times that I was able to get this firearm to fire. The first one being when the hammer was at rest on a loaded chamber. So as I previously described to you, the firing pin was sitting directly on the primer. So when I struck the hammer with the mallet, that provided enough force to detonate the primer. So again, that's a known feature of this type of firearm. The second test where this occurred was when the hammer was in the fully cocked position and I was doing my striking in the six planes as I described. And eventually I got to the rear of the firearm, so that back plane. And eventually at some point I struck the hammer with a rawhide mallet and the hammer actually fell and it detonated the primer. So what happened was some of the internal components of the firearm actually broke to allow that hammer to fall and fire the primed cartridge case. So I previously mentioned those quarter and half cock notches. If the hammer were to fall and there was no damage inside the gun, I would expect that the portion that makes contact with the hammer is called the sear. That sear should have been caught either by the quarter or the half cock notch as the hammer was falling. It should not have been able to fall all the way. So this is what led me to believe that there was some type of damage that occurred within the gun. And eventually I disassembled it to figure out exactly what that damage was.
So the damage that you discovered, just so we're clear, was that damage sustained at the FBI lab?
Yes, it was.
Based on the testing that you did, when this gun was received by the FBI, was it in proper working order?
Yes, so the first exam I did was the function exam. So again, that's making sure it's operating correctly and that it hasn't been modified. During that test, I also examined the safeties. So as it was received in that condition, when I went through the function evaluation, everything appeared to be operating correctly. So it functioned normally as it was designed.
So you were able to make it fire in the resting position, correct?
That's correct.
And then did you put it in the quarter cock position?
Yes.
And did you strike it with a mallet?
In that particular case, for the quarter as well as the half cock, I did not need to do the mallet testing.
What kind of testing did you do?
So the quarter and half cock notches are not designed to essentially lock the trigger, put your firearm completely in a safe setting. So again, they're designed that if your finger slips off the hammer, it's going to catch it. So in this type of gun, if your hammer is in either the quarter or the half cock, you can actually squeeze the trigger, and if you squeeze it hard enough, it's going to cock the hammer enough that it releases. So you can still make the hammer fall, even though it's in these two intermediate safety positions, if you apply sufficient pressure to the trigger. So I did a variety of testing to determine if I put the hammer in the quarter cock as well as the half cock notch and I squeeze the trigger hard enough that I allow the hammer to fall, is it even feasible for the hammer to detonate the cartridge? And I determined in both of those positions it was not.
And we understand that the next testing that you did was in the full cock position.
That's correct.
And ultimately, as you predicted, was the gun damaged?
As a result of the testing, yes, it was damaged.
Okay. Let's move to State's Exhibit 97A. Can you tell us what we're looking at here?
Yes, so this is a photograph that I took after the accidental discharge testing was complete. So on the right-hand side, we have the hammer. As I mentioned before, the firing pin is fixed to the hammer, so that's that piece that you see protruding from the hammer. In the top left, this piece is called the cylinder stop. So you can see a piece of that component fractured off. The bottom left here, we have the trigger, and this tiny piece here is what actually fractured off the trigger. Now, as I mentioned before, I explained the quarter and half cock notches, so I'm actually going to point those out to you. On the hammer, these kind of jagged edges, the first one is the quarter cock notch. So as you're cocking the hammer, you hear that first click. That is the sear portion of the trigger, which is now broken, locking into that little recess. Your second click is the half cock notch. So that's that second jagged edge. And then your last click is the actual sear notch. So that's where the trigger is sitting when the hammer is in its fully cocked position. So when I struck the hammer with the mallet, it actually broke off that piece of the trigger that was sitting up against the hammer there.
And is there anything unusual to you in this photo about the full cock notch on the hammer?
So again, this notch here is the full cock notch. So you may notice when looking at this that this notch appears much flatter when you compare it to the other two notches. So it could be that a small portion of this surface was also damaged during the testing. But in addition to that, there are times where the sear notch is just not as pronounced as the other two notches. So I didn't observe any damage myself in this particular area, but it's possible that that area was damaged as well.
And based on your testing, did you form an opinion about whether or not this gun could be fired without the handler pulling the trigger?
So again, the only two times that occurred was with the hammer at rest on a loaded chamber. And the second time, I attributed this to the breakage of internal components. So again, if these parts had not broken, I would expect that the trigger should have been caught by either the quarter or the half cock notch as the hammer was coming forward. So I would not expect this to occur had this breakage not happened.
So just to be clear, did you form an opinion about whether the handler would have to pull the trigger of the gun to make the gun fire?
My opinion is that the only reason this occurred is because of the breakage. So in order to move the trigger away from the hammer, that's typically accomplished by pulling the trigger. So in this case, the only way that was possible is because the trigger actually fractured.
Okay. So in order for you, just so that we're clear, in order for you to make the gun fire without pulling the trigger, when it was in the full cock position, you had to break it.
That's what I had to do in my lab. I can't account for all the other possibilities that may have existed in, you know, some hypothetical scenario, but this is the result as I tested it in my laboratory. It would not fire without pulling the trigger in the full cock setting without being broken.
Thank you. Let's move to State's Exhibit 98. Can you tell us what we're looking at here?
Yes, this is a photograph of the fired bullet that was submitted for comparison.
And can you describe to us in a little bit more detail what we're seeing in this photo?
This is the lead bullet that was submitted. It's very damaged. So typically when I look at a fired bullet, I would expect to see nice areas that are engraved with the negative impression of the barrel. So I'd expect to see, for example, deep lines that define what we call the rifling. And in this case, I don't see that. I just see a series of abrasions on the outside of this bullet. So essentially, whatever this bullet came into contact with, it basically damaged the exterior surface so greatly that the information that was left behind from the barrel is gone.
When you're talking about what the bullet came in contact with, I just want to be clear, are you talking about what the bullet came in contact with after it left the barrel of the gun?
That's correct.
State's Exhibit 99. Explain to us what we're looking at here.
So these are just additional images of the same fired bullet. So I took these using my microscope, so they're a little bit higher magnification. And basically, in both of these photos, the bullet is pointing to the left. So you're looking at the image of the left, you're looking at all of the damage and abrasions that were present on that bullet when I received it. And the image on the right is similar to the one you saw on the previous slide, where it doesn't have the deep gouges in different directions, but the rifling is still virtually gone from this bullet.
Can you tell us what caliber this bullet is?
When we receive fired bullets, the only way we can estimate the caliber is based on the diameter, so I can measure the diameter of the bullet, and also the bullet weight. So for those two items, they were very close between a .44 caliber and a .45 caliber bullet. So I classified it as either a .44 or .45 caliber bullet.
Can you explain to us why a .45 caliber bullet, by the time it gets to you, may have a different diameter and weight?
Sure. So this projectile is lead, which is a relatively soft material. Most modern bullets are going to have a harder jacketing material, so it's going to have a lead core with a harder jacket around it. The most common type is going to be copper, and that harder material is going to protect the lead core. It's going to help it keep its mass as it starts hitting things. But because this is lead, it's relatively soft, it's much more susceptible to damage when it hits things. So it's possible that when I receive a bullet or even a bullet fragment and I go to take a measurement of that bullet, it may be less than the true measurement because it's hit things and I now only have a partial bullet. Or conversely, it could actually be a wider diameter because it hits something and it flattens, so that causes it to expand. So that's why when I'm taking that measurement into consideration, I may not be able to narrow it down to just one specific caliber.
And States Exhibit 100, what's this?
These are two images of the fired cartridge case that was submitted for the examination. So the left image is from the side, and the right image, you're looking at what's called the head stamp of the cartridge. So the head stamp itself is the outer ring, where you're going to see information such as the caliber. So 45 Colt is the caliber. You may also see symbols which relate to the manufacturer. And then this silver-colored surface in the center here is the primer that I've been talking about. So this is what the firing pin comes into contact with when you pull the trigger. So this crater in the center, that's the firing pin impression. So when the firing pin falls, strikes the primer, it leaves behind an impression of the firing pin. And also during the firing pin, the firing process, the cartridge case rests up against a flat surface called the breech face. And during the firing process, this cartridge case slams into the breech face and it can pick up an impression of imperfections on that surface. So you may see some parallel lines. Some of these lines are kind of arcing. They almost appear to be crosshatch. Again, there's more parallel lines on the left here. That's an impression that this cartridge case has picked up from the breech face of the firearm.
Did you compare this casing with anything else, any other casings?
This was the only fired cartridge case that was submitted, but I did compare it to those known specimens that I collected from the revolver that was submitted.
And the known specimens, are those the ones that you fired out of the revolver yourself?
That's correct. That's the secondary evidence that I spoke about earlier. So I created that evidence in the lab by physically test firing the gun, and they became my knowns at that point.
Did you form an opinion about whether or not this cartridge casing was fired from the gun that we saw in the earlier exhibits?
Yes, it's my opinion that I identified this cartridge case as having been fired by the revolver.
State's Exhibit 101. What are we looking at here?
So these are representative images of the comparison that I did to get to that conclusion of identification. So if you look at the image on the left, this is two cartridge cases being compared side by side. And this is on my what's called comparison microscope. So at the laboratory, I have this microscope. I can mount two specimens. There are two separate microscopes connected by an optical bridge. And there's a binocular eyepiece at the top. So when I look through that binocular eyepiece, I can see images of both specimens side by side. So in the left image, there's this black line running down the center. That's what separates the two cartridge cases. So on the left side, you see my notes at the bottom here, F item 2, that's my annotation for that came from item 2, which is the revolver. So those are my knowns. On the right side is item 3, so that's the cartridge case that was submitted. And in the photo on the left, I'm comparing those breech face marks that I spoke about earlier. So the impression of that flat surface, I'm looking at the parallel lines as well as the crosshatch lines. And the image on the right, I'm looking at the features down within the firing pin impression.
Thank you. State's Exhibit 102. What's this?
These are four cartridges that were submitted for examination.
And when they were submitted to you for examination, were you given information about where they came from?
Yes, I do have that information that's been populated into the database.
And if you would tell us, just so that we know what your understanding was, just going to state of mind.
Right. It appears three of these were taken from the top of a cart, and the fourth was located in a holster inside of building. Those are the descriptions that I have.
Did you conduct any testing on these cartridges?
Yes, I did.
Tell us about that.
So the process that I spoke about earlier, first I just examined the physical characteristics of these cartridges. I then x-rayed them to see if I could learn anything more about the inside. And then the last step was to actually disassemble these cartridges.
And after going through all of that, did you form an opinion about whether these cartridges were dummies or live?
So these cartridges contain the four components that are required to be live functional ammunition. So that being the cartridge case, the bullet, in the bottom here is the primer, which you see in the center of the photograph on the right, and inside the cartridge case is going to be powder, which is the propellant. So these four cartridges had all four of those main components, which are consistent with being live ammunition.
Is there writing on the head stamp of that bullet? Or the cartridge, rather?
Yes, it's the head stamp of the cartridge. Again, so this is the bottom of the cartridge. It has the caliber and these kind of flower-type logos with a line indicate the manufacturer of the cartridge case.
And did all of these cartridges have that same indication on the head stamp?
Yes.
Did all of the cartridges have the same color primer?
Yes.
Did all of the cartridges have the same shape projectile?
Yes. So you can see in the image on the left the shape of the bullet here, as well as the color, the finish of the bullet. So these are what are called lead flat-nose bullets.
State's Exhibit 103. What are we looking at here?
This is a photograph of essentially a box of ammunition that was submitted to the lab. So on the right-hand side, you see information that's present on the exterior of the box. And on the left-hand side is the foam tray that's inside that box, as well as the cartridges that were inside it.
When this photo was taken, if you can tell us, had the order of the cartridges in the styrofoam insert been modified?
Yes, so generally a box of ammunition comes in with one item number, and when I opened it up, I saw various things, various calibers, various types of bullets. So I started to form groups based on what was in that box, and then I gave them their own sub-item number. So, for instance, I believe this was item 13, and I divided them based on the physical characteristics that I was seeing.
So the cartridges are in different positions in the styrofoam insert in this photo than they may have been at the time they were taken into evidence.
That is possible. I'm not sure what positions they were in at the time it was open.
And did you do any testing on these cartridges that were in this box?
Yes, I did the same series of testing that I've explained before.
And can you summarize for us what was in this box based on your examination and testing?
May I check my notes?
Just certainly.
So the vast majority of the cartridges that were in this box were dummy cartridges. And some of them had visual indicators. As I mentioned before, they may have a hole drilled in the side, or you could shake them. And again, that's an audible indicator. However, there was one cartridge in this box that, again, it had the four components required to be live ammunition.
And when you're looking at this photo, can you identify the cartridge that you believe was determined to be live?
I believe it was this one here with the silver primer.
Thank you. State's Exhibit 104. What's this?
This is actually two additional images of that cartridge that I just pointed out on the screen. So this is a side view of the cartridge on the left, and an image of the head stamp region on the right.
I want to talk to you about the characteristics of this cartridge compared to the four live cartridges that we saw earlier. Does this cartridge have the same shape, projectile, or bullet as the other four?
Yes, it does.
Does it have the same indication on the head stamp?
Yes.
And does it have the same color primer?
It does.
State's Exhibit 105. Can you tell us what we're looking at here?
These are images of additional ammunition that was submitted for examination. And these, some of the ammunition came in being declared as live ammunition. So these are images of some of those cartridges that were submitted.
So these are all live?
They were described as being live, and they had the physical characteristics of being live.
Based on the information that you received that went along with these cartridges, where did these cartridges come from?
May I refer?
Go ahead.
These cartridges are described as having come from Seth Kenny.
And do these cartridges, are they different than the live rounds, the five live rounds that we've seen photos of previously?
There are some differences, yes.
What are those?
So I see differences in the morphology of the bullet, so the shape of the bullet. For instance, this first one in the top left, this is actually a nickel-plated hollow-point bullet, so it's not the lead flat nose that you previously saw. The images below that, these bullet types are semi-wad cutters. So again, it's just a different design of bullet, so it's different in shape than the ones you previously saw. You also see additional head stamps here, such as Winchester, GFL, which is a trade name called Fiocchi, and as well as CBC, which is made by Magtech. And this, due to the glare, it's a little difficult to see in this photo, But I also believe there's differences in the colors of the primers.
And let me ask you, if you were to go to a gun store and buy a box of ammunition, would the ammunition in that box have different shaped projectiles?
No, if I was buying a, you know, a brand new box of ammunition, you go to Walmart, it's going to say on the outside what those bullet designs are. For example, it may say jacketed hollow point, it may say round nose, it may say truncated cone. So I would expect if I open that brand new box of ammunition, all of the bullet morphologies would be the same.
Thank you. State's Exhibit 106. What's this?
This is another series of photographs of another ammunition box that was scented. So in the top left, you see the exterior of the box. Bottom left, you see that foam insert as well as the cartridges. And then the image of the right on the right is just those cartridges being removed from the tray.
Can you tell us where these came from, at least what the description was that was provided to you?
Do you have an item number for this by chance?
I will get you one.
Okay. Item 28 was described as having come from the item 27 tray, which is the tray you see here, which was described as having come from the 26 box. And the 26 box was described as coming from 126 Monroe Street.
In your examination of these cartridges, were you able to make a determination about whether they were live or dummies?
May I refer to this?
Sure.
Okay, so these cartridges were submitted being declared as being live cartridges. So basically they were submitted and it was understood that these were live functioning ammunition. So I did disassemble two of these just to essentially verify that. And the two that I disassembled, again, it had the four main components that are required to be live functioning ammunition. So the ones that I didn't, they were described as being live, but the two that I did had all four components required.
Are there any differences in the characteristics of these live cartridges compared to the live cartridges that came from the set of the movie Rust?
Yeah, so again, in the bottom left, I see differences in primer color. These are brass as opposed to nickel. I can't read the head stamps in this photograph, but as far as the bullets go, these are also different because we have the ones that have this sort of little lip above the mouth.
Yeah. Sorry.
Those are called semi-wad cutters. And the other ones, which you see do not have that lip, these are called truncated cone. So the ones that you previously saw, these are different from flat nose because they don't have the rounded sides. It just goes straight. If you were to picture like an orange construction cone, it just goes straight up to the tip.
State's Exhibit 107. What's this? Well, and let's begin with what your understanding was of where they came from.
More raw courtroom audio from the Rust Alex Baldwin movie shooting trial is on the way.
Press subscribe so you don't miss a moment.
From the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.